From Springtime, Connecticut, Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation, executive director at the Global Center for Journalism and Trauma. Bruce, welcome.
Always glad to be here.
Now, last time we decided next time we'd look at Trump and the courts, and that time's arrived. A few days after the Supreme Court has shocked much of America by overturning 60 years of protection for minority voting rights. Bruce, what were the judges thinking?
What they were thinking is that all of this racism talk belongs to the past. This, while not a surprise, was nonetheless a shocking ruling from the conservative Supreme Court majority. It was a 6-3 ruling that found the key enforcement provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, passed at the height of the Civil Rights Revolution, to enable black voters to get representation, to get black officials elected through districting, right? Threw all of that out the window. And essentially, in a case involving the one majority minority district in Louisiana, the court majority said, oh, there was no intentional discrimination here. From now on, in order to prevail in a voting rights case or in order to have a majority minority district anywhere, you're going to have to prove deliberate discrimination. You're going to have to prove that a whole bunch of politicians deliberately set out to dilute black voting power. The dissenters, led by Justice Kagan, Elena Kagan, Bill Clinton nominee, of course, or Obama nominee, rather, of course, said this becomes an insurmountable barrier. You have to remember that the way black political power in the Jim Crow South was historically controlled was by the endless gerrymandering of districts that would stay white, 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 white. And essentially, the court majority has now opened the door to that kind of warfare again. And what's interesting about it is that it's not just an argument about, is all of that fighting from the civil rights era a thing of the past? It's not just an argument about what does racism look like? Is it racism if somebody doesn't actually say, I'm making a racist decision here? But rather, it is about kind of unleashing the ability to endlessly redistrict onto state legislatures, which we're already seeing in the wake of this. Louisiana, Alabama, and other states that have a small number of majority Democratic or majority black districts, their Republican legislatures, Florida, are already talking about quickly redistricting in order to help prevent a Democratic takeover of Congress this fall. And this is going to go back and forth and back and forth. It's doing for racially and politically motivated redistricting what the notorious Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, did for unleashing unregulated campaign funds. It is unleashing what will undoubtedly be a torrent of back and forth, highly polarized districting wars that will go on for years.
Bruce, one of the judges commented at one point that you don't need these protections anymore. But that is not a judgment. That is not something for judges to decide. That is a political decision.
In fact, the Voting Rights Act was really quite clear. It's quite clear that it was a decision by Congress, by the legislature, and essentially what the supposedly conservative, a word I really just can't use anymore to describe this reactionary majority, what this majority essentially said was, we don't care what Congress said. We don't really even care that the Constitution makes this kind of thing the matter of legislation. Our view is that all this racism is a thing of the past, and now it's really up to state legislatures to district however they want. And this isn't just a matter of Congress. This is, under the U.S. system, going to affect races from dog catcher and little municipal races all the way up to Congress and Senate and so on. I mean, this is a decision that of the most profound importance for the dilution of black political strength. We're already looking at perhaps a historic cut in fall in black political representation, the greatest since really the post-Reconstruction days after the Civil War.
Yours is a baffling country, Bruce. Of course, we've got rid of gerrymandering, but let's not boast that. We're just a little country that shows that you can run politics without gerrymandering. But
Well, you know, the U.S. showed that you could do it. For the last 60 years, the civil rights movement, led by, of course, by Dr. Martin Luther King and John Lewis and other courageous leaders, 60 years ago, they marched and sacrificed and got their heads beat in and in some cases were murdered in order to ensure that black folks could get political representation one way or another. This court, really for a generation, this gradually building court majority, it's not just a Trump thing at all, goes back to the Reagan years, has been steadily undercutting all of the legislation passed during the civil rights era, and this is one of the most profound cuts yet.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm speaking to Bruce Shapiro about the courts in America. Now, Bruce, it's your view that these massive defamation cases that Trump is mounting have a deeper purpose. What is that purpose?
Well, interestingly, this ties back to the civil rights era. Back in 1964, in a case involving criticism of public officials in the segregated South, the U.S. Supreme Court, in another one of the high watermarks for civil liberties, declared that public officials need to take their lumps, that free speech in America means robust, even caustic criticism of public officials, and that if for a public official to sue someone for defamation or to prevail in a libel case, you really got to prove what they call absolute malice, deliberate malice, actual malice. Donald Trump, of course, has become famous, and his circle and his officials for turning around every 5 minutes and suing some journalist for defamation. Trump sued Rupert Murdoch in the Wall Street Journal. Cash Patel has sued the Atlantic Monthly, which pointed out that agents have been calling him J. Edgar Boozer. Sorry, I just had to get that in.
And we're grateful that you did, Bruce. We're grateful.
And, you know, on the surface, you can say, well, these are just strategic lawsuits against public participation, slap suits. They're designed to intimidate. But really, what they are trying to do is hoping that one of these cases, which judges keep throwing out of court, like the Wall Street Journal case, which got 2 weeks ago a federal judge dismissed out of hand as ridiculously unjustified under that 1964 ruling.
How much was he after from Rupert Murdoch?
$10 billion.
$10 billion,
And both the amount, but also the terrain of the lawsuit. It was for a news story involving Trump's relationship with Epstein. It was all factually accurate.
Oh, it was
accurate.
About the birthday card.
It was about the birthday
We've
card.
We've seen and, the birthday you know, card.
There was no actual malice, and also fact is an absolute protection under New York Times versus Sullivan, the great precedent from the civil rights era that has defined American political speech for more than a half century. Trump and his cohort are hoping that one of these cases will get to the Supreme Court, and is hoping that today's Supreme Court will in fact overrule that civil rights era case and will make it much easier for public officials and other public figures to sue for defamation, to intimidate critics. And there's a good reason to think they might rule that way. Several of the current sitting justices, Justice Clarence Thomas, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, both of them confirmed under the shadow of sexual abuse allegations, have publicly criticized that New York Times versus Sullivan decision from 1964. So there's real hope in the Trump world that somehow the power of billionaires and oligarchs and politicians to intimidate their opponents through defamation cases and libel cases will somehow be restored to the American landscape as it existed during the Jim Crow era and as it existed prior to that crucial First Amendment decision in 1964.
Meanwhile, Bruce, how's Trump's record on obeying the courts, on doing what they direct his administration to do?
Well, this, of course, is he's key. Trump will appeal, first of all, as he has done in the case of the defamation case he lost, the defamation case brought by E. Jean Carroll, whom he actually did defame, and he's owed he owes $65 million to. There, he's refused to pay it and is appealing it. So that's one rule. But secondly, what we've seen over and over again in this second Trump administration is when the federal courts issue rulings on immigration enforcement, issue rulings on funding, issue rulings on the firings of USAID officials and closures of federal agencies. When courts rule against Trump, he simply ignores them and barrels forward. We've begun to see some courts getting very tough in their language with the real threat of contempt of court. But of course, we've already had, again, the Supreme Court majority holding the president himself exempt from criminal prosecution during his term. So, you know, Trump thinks he's on pretty high ground in defying courts over and over again. So what we're seeing are courts becoming an instrument of politics by other means, an instrument of continuing and extending the spectacle of right-wing politics and of Trump anarchy and enrichment.
And of course, the enrichment is the point, surely, that along the way, even if he isn't yet able to boot one of these cases up to the Supreme Court, he's making money along the way. People are settling with him, $15 million here, $20 million there. It all helps,
Bruce. Well, it helps. Well, no, and there's extraordinary amounts of money that involved in people who don't want to fight these cases. We've also seen some of the great institutions of American society, law firms, universities, including my own former employer, Columbia University, settle not to pay Trump personally, but to pay the federal government huge amounts of money. We even have now the extraordinary spectacle of a case that Trump, as president, has brought against his own government, against the IRS, for fines it says he owes them. And the novel question has come up, can the Justice Department, which works for Trump, prosecute a case or defend a case, or what side is the Justice Department on? We're in an extraordinary moment in which the courts are simply becoming another vehicle for the Trump circus.
And for extraordinary moments, we rely on Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation, executive director at the Global Center for Journalism and Trauma. Bruce, thank you.